Welcome to another episode of the Reboot Chronicles, a no-holds-barred forum with global leaders, authors, entrepreneurs, and CEOs about how organizations stay focused on growth and innovation in unprecedented times. I'm your host, Dean DeBias, coming to you live from Reviv's North American headquarters in Chicago, and we would like to thank you for joining us from around the globe today. I'd like to welcome Scott Miller back to the Reboot Chronicles. He is a multi-best-selling author, radio and podcast host, leadership coach, columnist, and global keynote speaker. Scott's latest book, Master Mentors Volume 2, includes 30 transformative insights from some of the world's greatest minds that we could all use now. You know, like me, Scott seems to be always doing too many things, but I think they're good things. He's not one of those annoying multitaskers who is kind of paying attention to you when you're having lunch together. I think he listens, he cares, and he helps people. And lately, he's been quite busy traveling the globe on his book and speaking tour. But we got him to take a quick pause with us and join us on the air today. Scott, it's so good to see you.
Dean, great to see you, man. Thank you for the platform, the spotlight, and I'm wishing you and your neighbors in Southwest Florida a strong recovery and a resilient spirit post the recent hurricane.
I appreciate that. Coming from you, a Florida native, that's great to hear. Hey, maybe that's a good place to start since you did live down here years ago when you were a child. You were famously fired from or kicked out from Disney, which I would consider a badge of honor, quite frankly. But tell us about that, and how did that help reboot you? Flash forward now, years later, you're kind of a guru now.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I appreciate the setup. I worked for the Disney Company for 4 years, the Disney Development Company, which is the real estate arm, or was at least, of the Walt Disney Company, and worked on the town of Celebration, was one of the first team members of Celebration, had a great career at Walt Disney, wrong fit culturally for me. And
Celebration, was that the precursor to Epcot or something?
Well, so actually Celebration was Walt Disney's original idea for Epcot, right? Okay. Sort of the amalgamation of the Jetsons meets Mayberry, you know, sort of that technology innovation of the future with the values of the yesteryears. An amazing, amazing project. Had a great run there. Learned a ton. Was the only non-Ivy League graduate degree member of the entire team. Everyone was from Wharton or Stanford or, you know, Penn or somewhere, Harvard. But I had a great run there. They invited me to leave, a bit of a shock. But quite frankly, I kind of behaved myself into a reputation that was not what I wanted to be the rest of my career. Probably the best reboot of my life. I think the worst day of your life is the day you're fired. And the best day of your life is the next day when you probably were relieved of a burden that you didn't fully know anyway. And so I think sometimes being relieved of responsibility, maybe to your horror, is a great thing. In life, I generally tend to live my mindset around this idea of sometimes a disappointment turns into an appointment. Yes. And so whenever I get bad news or a setback, I always immediately think, okay, what's the silver lining? Yes, I may have lost a large client. Great. Now I've got 70 hours to deploy somewhere else. Or maybe, you know, this or that was canceled. What else should I focus on, including maybe myself? So I think generally my biggest lesson is to look for the silver lining. And as I'm rebooting, think about, okay, this has happened for a reason, may well be out of my control. What now? What's the lesson for me to learn that I don't repeat?
I like that. Your positive energy is intoxicating. By the way, does that work for relationships, boyfriend, girlfriend stuff too, or that rule?
Oh, I've been dumped. Yeah, I mean, not by my wife, fortunately, but by others. I'm sure there's the principle of sometimes a disappointment turns into appointment is all how you manage it, right? I mean, we know this adage to be true. Life is 10% what happens to you and 90% how you react to it.
Why is it that way always?
And I think as I've matured, I'm much more in control of my reaction to perhaps things that I can't completely control, or if I could, I can no longer control it.
Yeah. Why is it that we always forget that 10-90% thing you just said? It's such good advice.
We're humans because we're emotional humans, right? And we like to be in control and we like to not be humiliated by others. We don't want other people making decisions on our behalf. But I was a fairly impulsive, impetuous person. And as I've gotten older, I'm a little more discerning about how easily I'm lured in to reacting to somebody else's stuff. If I can't control it, and there's a certain amount I can control, But if I know I can't control it, then I just pivot on, move on.
That's actually a good, that's a good little thing for people to realize, because they usually just keep hitting it and grinding on it over and over and over again. Well, let's jump into that in a second. Can I ask you some personal stuff first? Is that all right? I think I just did, but let's do it again. So you're one of the few friends that actually post personal stuff on LinkedIn. Most people put all that on Facebook, and I don't do a lot of personal stuff on LinkedIn. And now I've been watching you. I'm like, maybe I should. I like you pose these everyday life questions about whether or not you should do this or that. And then you talk about something called Millerland, which sounds, it's not a, you know, beer commercial. It's your last name. Seems like a chaotic place. What is that? And how does it?
Well, Millerland is my life. My wife, Stephanie, and I have three young boys that are 8, 10, and 12, and two boy dogs. And so those all have my personality. They have my energy, my DNA. So my wife is always at a disadvantage. And Millerland is the compilation of the five people in our family and our dogs and our friends. And you're right, I do. I post a lot of personal things on LinkedIn because I think, you know, your career now is no longer separate from your life. It used to be, Dean, we all had our personal lives and our professional lives, and we had our secret lives. Everyone's got a secret
TikTok
life.
No, sorry.
And I think increasingly, whether it's, you know, post-pandemic or post-Black Lives Matter or post-LGBTQ or post you name it, everyone's bringing their whole selves to work now. There's upsides and downsides with that, but I think it's important for people to see the whole side of me, not just me as an author or in cufflinks on a podcast, but to recognize that, like you, I've got financial pressures. Like you, I've got health issues and parents and a father that passed away. And I like people to see the ups and the downs. I mean, this morning, I just got back from Croatia where I was giving a speech, and I have 8 cities that I haven't expensed my receipts for. So I put all the receipts on the ground on big pieces of paper, and my dog comes in and both drops some liquid and some solids on them. Like literally on the floor, my puppy drops a combination of liquids and solids on my receipts. This is life. Will I post it? Probably not, but I might. You never know.
Nope.
I posted a picture of my colonoscopy on LinkedIn. I got a lot of vitriol for
that one.
I got a lot of vitriol.
You did post the one about your dad's storage unit, and that one resonated with me. Not just about reflecting on our fathers and parents, but really about how you drag all this stuff to the next job, to the next level, to the what it's weighting you down. I thought it was a good message. You're good at metaphors too, obviously.
Well, I appreciate that.
How's all that?
I'm not trying to make.
I was wondering how all the personal side I kind of affects the direction of your writing and your books and stuff.
Oh, it definitely does. I mean, I think the most consistent compliment I receive is from people saying they find my vulnerability refreshing. You know, I'm not an open kimono. I mean, I'm a Catholic, so I'm used to the confession part of life. But I think it's built a unique brand for me to say, hey, I'm very comfortable talking about my stutter. I'm comfortable talking about my ups and downs as a parent and the fact that my credit score is factually higher than my SAT score was. So I think it's helpful to know, you know, who we are isn't who we're going to be. We can mature. And I think my ability to try to be relatable is built a following and a brand for me.
And you're right in the middle of this series of mentor books, which you've talked about before in the program. You're one of the few people to invite back, and very few.
Thank you.
The Why the Mentor series, you're on volume 2 now. So tell us about that. And then now, next question will be, where's it going?
Sure. So like you, I'm privileged to host a large podcast where each week I get to interview, you know, celebrities and business titans, best-selling authors, people who've survived a trauma and can teach us what to learn from that. And what I found, Dean, probably like you, is some of the good stuff was off air. It was, you know, in the 5 or 6 minutes beforehand or at the end. I'm like, oh my gosh, why didn't you share that on screen? That's like a golden nugget. So it's the best stuff. And so with the permission of the guest and HarperCollins' confidence in me, I've got a 10-year, 10-book deal with HarperCollins called Master Mentors, 30 Transformative Insights from Our Greatest Minds. And every year I pick 30 people from the podcast and I write something about an insight they shared. Easy breezy. This is not Jim Collins, Good to Great, a bit more like Chicken Soup for the Soul, short chapters. And with their permission, I give them credit for it because I don't believe that mentoring only has to be in a company where you're matched as a mentee with somebody on the executive suite for 7 Fridays in a row, yeah, and it's
that's
done.
That's old school.
I found that the biggest mentors in my life were people that didn't know me, but I read their books and listened to their podcasts and went to their conferences and followed them. And I don't think everyone has to be a formal mentor in your life to be a mentor in your life. And that's what this series is about, is exposing a broader audience to amazing people that have written amazing books or just had amazing experiences and really turning the spotlight onto them.
Do you talk about, I don't know what the right word is, shadow mentors? For instance, a couple of my mentors, they actually didn't know about the relationship. So when I worked at FedEx, Fred Smith was one of my mentors, as was Jim Barksdale, is number two. And that's where I learned the hardcore side of, you know, business. And then with other CEOs, it was, I guess you call it modeling, probably in a child kind of relationship. Do you talk about much of that, or is it always? Because I think you're right. The old formal stuffy mentor relationship thing just seems like that was a nice era, but let's move on.
Well, it's still happening in some companies, but obviously, you know, post-pandemic life and this kind of hybrid world, it is more difficult to get formal mentors that can meet with you. Just the politics and culture of companies has changed. Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. Whether it's on one end, a formal mentoring program, or in the middle, kind of like shadow mentorship, where you know the person, but you've not formally asked them to mentor you. You're just sucking the wisdom out of them without them knowing about it. Or in the far end, where perhaps you're being mentored by someone that you don't even know. I think you've got to get clear on what it is you're trying to accomplish. What do you want to learn and do? And then surround yourself formally, informally, with a variety of mentors throughout your entire life. I don't know anybody, you or me, that's had any modicum of success that hasn't done it with some type of mentorship. It's a key component to success in life.
So you just said what the mentee, they should have a goal, but I often find it's the mentor that kind of sets the agenda, and it's actually backwards. It's the receiver that needs to dictate. Is that right?
Yeah. I have a point of view on this.
It sounds like common sense, but when you said it, I'm like, wow, I don't think it always happens the right way.
Well, I think what usually happens is you get someone like you or I that has a successful career, big personality. We're used to making decisions and setting the agenda and leading the conversation. And we're also used to imprinting our mentee with our formula for success. Dean, not everybody has your journey. Not everybody has my energy. Not everybody has, you know, your personality. So I think the biggest mistake mentors make is when they say, well, if I was you, well, no, you're not them. You're never going to be them. And as a mentor, your job is to listen, absorb. It's to determine, has anything on your journey proven to be replicable for their journey? Which is why I think the mentee needs to lead the conversation. Now, the mentor might need to set some boundaries, right? Do not ask me to fund your business. Do not ask me to open up my Rolodex for you. Make sure that you show up on time. So the mentor might need to set some boundaries, depending upon the relationship. But I think it's the mentee's job to make sure they're clear. What is it they're trying to accomplish? And how can the wisdom of the journey of the mentor help ignite the genius on their journey? I'm writing a book for HarperCollins called The Ultimate Guide to Great Mentoring. And I've identified 15 roles that mentors should play and should not play.
That's actually a great blueprint. Yeah. Only 15. That's surprising with you. So tell me about some of the excerpts, contributors. Give us, what are some of your faves?
In Master Mentors?
Yeah, you can't have faves. It's like your three boys. I know. But yeah, share. Share some things.
Yeah, I mean, Marie Forleo wrote a book called Everything is Figureoutable, New York Times bestseller. It basically reminded me of Dr. Covey, who raised me and the Franklin Covey Company, to use your R and your I. Dr. Covey, of course, who wrote the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, used to teach us in the company, use your R and your I, your resourcefulness and your initiative. And this has allowed me to conquer things I never thought I could, just being resourceful, doggedly determined to figure it out, show humility, ask questions, absorb and learn. Big fan of Marie Forleo. There's a guy named Bobby Herrera that wrote a book called The Gift of Struggle. An entrepreneur, Latino, family born in Mexico of humble means, one of 13 people. He was actually born in New Mexico when his father moved to work on a farm. And he went on to become a very successful entrepreneur. But in high school, Bobby Herrera was a member of the basketball team. And every night after playing basketball, the school bus would stop at a restaurant and everybody got off and had dinner, except for the Herrera brothers. They stayed on the bus after every game because with 13 kids, there was no money for dinner. This wasn't Ruth's Chris. This was like the Ponderosa. And until one night, one of the kids' fathers reboarded the bus, walked back to the Herrera brothers and said, "Gentlemen, I'd like for you to join us at dinner tonight. Be my guest. I'm going to pay. No one's going to know. And all I want you to do in the future is just work your way to pay it forward to somebody else." And Bobby says it was the first time in his life, I'm getting emotional telling the story, because it was the first time in his life that he'd ever felt seen by anybody, especially this prominent businessman, a father to a teammate. And the lesson there is, you know, who reboarded the bus for you in life? Who made you feel seen? Who will you reboard the bus for?
Or who
so many great
who
people.
Recognizes your struggle in order to help you with it? Because usually we don't recognize,
right.
I don't know what you're struggling with. I mean, I see a picture of you, those of you that aren't on video, with all your books behind you. It looks beautiful frame shot, by the way. But I don't know what you're struggling with. I mean, you know, you've got a dog down there eating receipts from your trip to Croatia. I know that much, but
I wish he was beating them.
We're all struggling with different things. That is a big part of what mentor-mentee developmental relationship things need to be about. It's like, how do you actually discover what it is? Because I might not be A, willing to talk about it. B, I might, as a mentee, I might not even recognize it.
You know, Dean, that's a perfect setup. Vulnerability is a leadership competency in 2022 and beyond. Just like reading a P&L, just like working through an acquisition, like calculating EBITDA, vulnerability is a leadership competency. So when you are a mentor or you are a leader, there's a time when it's appropriate to talk about your biggest failure, the deal that went south, the high courage conversation you have with a colleague that you regret because you didn't do this or do that, you know, with you know, confidential things being held confidential. As a mentor, as a leader, the more you're willing to demonstrate strength through vulnerability, you're not the genius in the room. Your job is the genius maker of others, to quote Liz Wiseman, also in Master Mentors, Volume 1. When you demonstrate the comfortability you have with vulnerability, you give license to your mentee to do the same, right? You didn't, Dean, fall out of your mother's womb with that success you've had in your career. You had lots of ups and downs and setbacks, and the more you're willing to talk about them, the more I can relate to you. The more I can say, oh, great, I don't have to choose my words so carefully. I don't have to feign, you know, confidence. I can just be real and say, Dean, I'm scared about this. What do I do next? What would you do? Not what would you do if you were me? What would you do that you're you? And could I even replicate that with my own fears and my own passions and dreams? Mentorship is a big responsibility. It's important that you don't try to transfer your passion and your skills onto your mentee. You've got to be vulnerable enough to say, hey, tell me, what scares you in life? What fears do you have? So that you can meet them where they are.
That's my biggest takeaway here. Well, it's not just what fears you have. It's like you fear talking about those things. Literally, being honest about it. I know I have that trouble. I have trouble. I have so many great stories and they're not great. They're just not in the depth of it. They were really tough. And some of us don't want to talk about it. We learned that from our World War II fathers, for gosh sakes. They didn't talk about anything. So we were trained very well not to do that. But it all seems to be coming out. Now I know why you're writing this series, because it is what is missing in societies all over the world, which is the transference that of helping the next generation really be better, not withholding so much, but actually sharing. And it's just not prevalent enough in society today. And you see it not just in the bad neighborhoods, every part of society, every nationality, pretty much in every country you and I travel to, we see it. Maybe with the exception of a few. There's a few societies and cultures that still do it. You know, old European cultures, some Far Eastern cultures, where it's part of the growing up. It's like there's a rite of passage, as we used to call it. And does the book talk about business mentoring, which is usually what we're talking about here, versus personal versus whatever? But, you know, I'm drifting back now into your whole life on LinkedIn, not just your work life, but are you covering all the bases?
I do. It's interesting. When I first wanted to write this book, a publisher passed on me. In fact, a publisher who had already published two of my books, they were quite bullish.
Yep.
They felt like the book was too episodic. They wanted a red thread, everything about strategy or everything about baseball, something. I said, no, that's not what I want to write. I want to write an intentionally episodic book. So to your point, I'm looking at the, you know, here's the book, the back cover lists all of the mentors and their insights. I mean, Martin Lindstrom, right? He wrote the book Biology. He talks about common sense, and Alex Osterwalder, who wrote the Synergizer series, Knowing the Business of Your Business. Jeffrey Moore, who wrote Crossing the Chasm. I mean, there's some amazing business authors. John Huntsman, the former governor of Utah and ambassador to Singapore, Russia, and China, writes some great stories around just the value of hard work. So there's stories about listening and leadership and parenting, business model creation, and understanding the language you're speaking. The former chief people officer of Netflix, Patty McCord, making sure you're not talking human resource speak, but you're talking the business of the business, and knowing that you've got to be multilingual in business. So many great interviews. Sean Covey, who wrote the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Teams. Yeah. I write about the difference between self-confidence, self-esteem, and self-worth. We use those words interchangeably, but they're very different concepts. So yeah, it does range personal, professional, hardcore business stuff, and how to be a great parent.
Mm. You're still trying to figure that out, is what you've told me.
True,
no, you're a great dad. So
the youngest one's kicking my ass.
Any, I know the book just came out, available everywhere, of course, folks. Yeah. Any examples of how it's helping people? Maybe
volume
one.
I have a great story from volume two. It just came out last week. I held a launch party here in Salt Lake City. 150 people showed up at a restaurant, and we told stories. Five of the mentors flew in for it. Three of them came locally. And I invited a broad variety of people. It was invite only because I can't have 1,000 people show up. That would be very expensive.
It's a lot of champagne.
And I invited a woman that had been following me on Facebook and LinkedIn. She manages a restaurant in a nearby state. And she follows me on social media and comments, you know, occasionally. This woman is a manager of the Wendy's. And I said, hey, why don't you come to the party? She said, are you kidding me? She said, it's invite only. I said, I know, it's my party. I'm inviting you. Come over. It's a 3-hour drive. She showed up, hugged her, knew who she was immediately from her Facebook profile. She probably felt out of her element. And that night, she drove back to Wyoming 3 hours later, and she sent me the most tender message with her permission I'm sharing. She said, one of the best nights of my life. She said, I couldn't understand why a man, this is what she said. She said, I couldn't understand a man of your stature, why he would ever invite me to come into your world. I was so nervous coming. All these business leaders and titans and celebrities and the press was there. She said, and then she said, the moment I walked in the restaurant, you hugged me, you welcomed me, and all that washed away. I'm so grateful for you making me feel like an equal. I feel seen by you. She was there. Bobby Herrera, the Gift of Struggle guy, was there telling the story. And so that's a story I would share to say, you know, we all have the same self-worth. Our self-worth is the same. It's creator given. If you're religious, it's God given. If you're not, it's, you know, whoever created you is given. But our self-worth is the same. Our self-confidence and our self-esteem fluctuates wildly based on how we allow people to treat us, how we choose to show up. And so that's a story of someone who saw me as not her equal. I don't know why. I mean, I can guess why, but we're absolutely equal. We're both achieving our own great purposes with you know, the talents we have and the fears we have and the head start some of us had and the humility. And so that's a story that I really, it was very tender to me.
Yeah. And if you take a Venn diagram of those three things, self-worth, self-value, self-esteem, what's in the center there? Sorry, getting professorial on you here.
No, I
just
like
gave you
that.
An idea for your new book.
Yeah, I mean, my answer would be is really getting clear on what your mission is, right? I mean, why you're here. I don't know why I'm here. Increasingly, I think it's to raise these three young sons, but people who follow me know I was kind of a reluctant parent. I didn't want to have children. She was hot. I married her, and she wanted kids, and so that was part of the deal. And she's still around, and she's still hot and smart and picking my ass. and I deserve it. I think your purpose, right? Finding your purpose and your mission is the center of self-esteem, self-confidence, and self-worth.
That'll work for today, of course. Let's go back to that posting everything on LinkedIn that you shouldn't, your personal lives, because it's been blown away in the 20s. So going into 2023, 24 now, it's just like everything's on the table. Show everyone who you are. So the question in that is, in this hyper-connected, neurotic, digital screen world, you know, how do you, I'll just say an old thing, how do you manage that work-life balance? Because you still have work and you still have, you know, your non-work stuff. It's like,
yeah.
And then it's like, you don't. I mean, you're laughing. I see you laughing at the question. Yeah. Any tips on that?
Yeah, I'll share a maybe unpopular idea. I think it's probably bunk. There's probably no such thing as work-life balance when in a hyper-connected world where my phone, I get about 600 emails a day. I probably get another 600 to 700 social media messages. I'm over 1,000 inbound.
I'm looking for my
points of information.
Yeah, I'm just going to inject. I'm looking for my phone. I can't find it. But we used to measure, I'm in the tech industry, how many times people looked at their phone a day. We stopped measuring it because they're always looking at it. We can't even measure it anymore.
Yes, right.
Anyway.
Right. So the premise probably is work-life balance in and of how we think of it probably is a myth. Jillian Michaels is a friend of mine. I've interviewed her on several occasions, you know, the TV celebrity and a nutritionist, health, wellness expert. And she said, you know, you can have it all, just not at the same time. And she talked about this idea that I try to follow, which is there are seasons in our life. There are seasons of balance. There are seasons of imbalance. I'm launching 4 books in the next year. I'm getting ready to potentially produce a TV program for CNBC. I'm a host of 2 podcasts. I have 3 kids. I've got an online course. I own a literary talent and speaking agency that's exploding.
Sounds like you're in the imbalance phase right now.
Totally imbalance. 3 months ago in June, my family went to Italy for 10 days and I was completely disconnected.
Oh, it was on LinkedIn. I saw it.
It was on LinkedIn, but I was having fun. I was not writing a single chapter. I wasn't writing columns for magazines. I wasn't reading books for the podcast. I was reading fiction and drinking champagne and playing in the pool with my boys. So my best suggestion is recognize there's going to be times of imbalance. I'm in a multi-city tour doing hundreds of interviews in the next 6 or so weeks. And then come Thanksgiving, I will take a week off and I will do my best to shut down and get back in balance. That's been my solution, is to surround myself with really competent people and trust them to make smart decisions in the business with me and for me. And then recognize there's times of balance and times of imbalance. And like seasons, you can't always be in summer. You're going to move to fall, and fall is natural. Fall happens whether you want it to or not. And so you've got to be in control of when you deliberately move into your next season.
Exactly.
Maybe you're not going to Italy for 10 days. Your season might be 3 days. It might be 3 weeks. We don't all have the luxury of checking out for 10 days. It's a rarity for me.
Yeah, I used to call them micro sabbaticals. Take them off. And that's why I ask, because people don't, in the hyper-connected world, they don't get to it enough, including myself, by the way.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In the minute or so we have left, I want to thank you for joining again, by the way. How about a really personal story where you did struggle and people can learn from it without crying or anything?
Why am I crying? Is it okay?
I'm talking about me. Any parting words that would help people? Because people love yours.
I'm a lifelong stutterer. I have a really debilitating speech impediment. There are probably 30 words I cannot say in public. It triples in the wintertime because the cold weather greatly exacerbates my stutter. And so I've had to become a voracious reader to build a massive vocabulary so that when I know a stutter word is coming up, I take a metaphorical off-ramp in my car, get into a rest stop and pick up a word and come back on, which is sometimes why I say strange things, because the stutter word is coming up and the word that I'm picking up may not be an exact replacement. But I talk about it freely and openly, and inevitably someone comes up to me after a speech or a keynote and talks about their stutter or their metaphorical stutter. I don't use it gratuitously. I don't try to talk about it to have you feel more endeared to me. But like you said earlier, everybody's got something going on in their life, right? A bill they can't pay, an in-law moving into dementia, a fear they have, a teenage son who's doing something naughty. Everyone's got something going on. Everyone's got a hidden story. I think the more patient the more kind and empathetic to realize people behave the way they do for a reason. Clinically, only 10% of the population are truly sociopaths. The other 90% of us are just trying to struggle through and make it through life. And so maybe all of us could be a little more forgiving, recognizing that everybody's got a hidden story and you may not know what their stutter is.
I love it. Thanks, Scott. My lesson from that is don't hide stuff, just show it. And you're a great example of that. You've been listening to Scott Miller, a regular on the Reboot Chronicles. This is Dean DeBias. We want to thank you for joining us today. We will see you soon.